Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Bruce Schneier joins us, says security needs to be regulated. Also, tearing the Pixel 3 XL apart. I'm not going to actually do it with mine, but we'll talk about it. I wouldn't dare do it with this one. How Duolingo reached 50-50 gender parity and the complicated story of the bagel emoji. All that more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 54, recorded Thursday, October 18th, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit.
And by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit.
Welcome to the show. This is Tech News Weekly, of course, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. It's good to be back. Mm-hmm. You knocked it out of the park last week. Thank you, Megan.
And
I appreciate
you 2 weeks ago.
That's true. This is like our first reunited. Together. It feels so good.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Online security breaches, high-profile hacks, government agency insecurities. It really feels like the state of security is on high alert, constantly moving a mile a minute. It's almost impossible to keep up. Our next guest argues that things are only going to get worse, and he should know. Welcome to the show, cryptographer, lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, and author of the new book that we happen to have right here, Click Here to Kill Everybody, Bruce Schneier. How are you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing great. How's everybody?
I was good until I read the title of your book, and then I was scared.
I mean, and like, the title is really just meant to like reel you in the bookstore. I kind of back off at the like page three, but you know, this is what we're talking about.
Absolutely. So you, we're bringing you on today partially because of the book. It's very apropos to the topic that you wrote about in an op-ed for the New York Times last week. You posited there that security has become too important, too difficult for the free, almost for the free market to enforce on its own. What's different now from even 5 or 10 years ago that's making security so incredibly difficult at this point?
So what I talked about in the article and also in the book is our relationship with computers are changing. They're no longer screens that we go to deliberately and deal with data. They're objects in our environment that affect the world. So I talk about autonomy, automation, and physical agency. What's changing is computers now do stuff in our world. They drive our cars. They turn our thermostats on. They send life-saving electricity into our hearts to revive us when we have a problem. And that just makes it different. It's not about data, it's about life and property. So what's changing is how computers are being used. We're trying to use the same old security in this new environment, and that's going to fail.
So speaking of failing, you have some tenets. You do write in the book about what a secure internet might look like, and you have these tenets, which are all great, and some which I would assume are obvious, but apparently are not. One of the most interesting ones is that our machines should fail, our computers should fail gracefully, safely, and predictably. So what does that look like for example, the Schlage lock that locks my front door, which I love because then none of my children need keys and we just use a code to get in and out. So when that fails, how would it fail predictably and safely and not destroy my home, lock me out or in or something like that?
Well, maybe it fails that it has a key also. So it's not only electronic. And I'm making this up. The problem is, as you describe, that this is a computer. The computer can be hacked. It can fail. Lots of things can happen. And you don't want to be locked out of your house. So maybe there is some manual override, some manual backup, where if the electronic part doesn't work, you can still get in. Mm-hmm. Right, failing gracefully, you think of it as fail safe. Right, when you take your foot off the accelerator, the car slows down. It doesn't, when you take your hand off the steering wheel, it doesn't veer to the left. It just tends to go straight. And those kind of mechanisms are pretty common in safety. We have them lessen security, right? Fail in some safe and secure manner. Don't fail in some catastrophic manner. Some of it's going to be design, right? Don't have a default password so that all the things don't fail at once. Some of it is kind of these manual overrides. I've heard it called Faraday mode. If I have an internet-connected refrigerator and the internet goes down, I want the refrigerator to still keep things cold. So it's going to mean different things in different contexts.
Obviously, the Schlage lock is just one example of this whole IoT craze that's a really, you know, really big deal, big movement. We're kind of, on one hand, we're in a moment in time where, you know, computers enable us to do so many things that seemed like science fiction years ago. Yet here we are, and it's great that that's happening. But IoT seems to be kind of the critical point in all of this, right? Is it the sleeping giant? Is it a problem that can't be ignored anymore? And why has it failed in terms of security so hard?
You know, it's interesting. It is the big thing. It is us moving computers into our environment. You know, you just read the numbers. It's going to be huge. It'll be bigger than computers and phones. It'll be how we interact with computing, with the internet. I think it's going to change a lot of things. And why it's failing is an interesting question. Some of it is that these non-computer manufacturers are becoming computer manufacturers. A lot of the lessons we learned the hard way with computers are now being learned again with refrigerators and appliances and toys and even cars. Some of it is that these computers are being designed differently at a lower profit margin. You know, we have a team of engineers at Apple and Google and Microsoft writing patches when our computers and phones fail. There isn't that team for home routers or internet-connected toys or webcams like what I'm speaking to you on. They don't have security teams. They can't be patched. They're a much lower cost. The economics is completely different. We've built our security around the old economics.
And I mean, the idea was originally everything should be able to connect to the internet because that, right, you know, that was the magic of it back in the day. And I mean, that's sort of still the same thing. Like, I want my smart home. I want everything to connect easily. It's super frustrating when it doesn't. I want everything to be on HomeKit with Apple, and there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work, and I'm told that's because it's less secure, and that's frustrating too. So, I mean, what does it look like? What is the secure internet look like besides those tenets that you outline, that I mentioned before, the ones that should be obvious, vendors not shipping stuff with vulnerabilities, which I guess still happens. What are some other ways that the secure internet will look like in the future if everyone obeys your rules?
Well, I don't think it'll be by disconnecting things, right? The internet is coming to all these objects, and it is the future, and it's a great idea, and it'll cause all sorts of benefits we can't imagine. So really, how do we build resilience? How do we design our internet so that there are these devices that will be insecure, will have vulnerabilities, will be hacked, and it isn't a catastrophe? Right? Because so we can imagine our something in our home that is monitoring everything else. We can manage. We can imagine ways to fail safely or securely. I generally think of it as resilience. How do we build more resilient systems? We're not going to conserve our way out of this. We're not going to say, you know, don't have internet connected this and that, because you're right. This is the promise. This is the future. And it's what we're going to have. How do we build security anyway? I mean, there are real engineering challenges. I argue that they are go to the moon hard and not faster than light travel hard. But really, my book is about policy. What kind of policies do we need to incent companies not to ship software with the vulnerabilities? You know, and that's going to be where we have to push our effort. It's not going to be smart consumers paying more. It's going to be regulations. It's the way we get security in cars and airplanes and pharmaceuticals and everything else.
So regulations, obviously, and you know, I know that you talk a lot about that. You definitely talked about that a little bit in the op-ed. What that kind of brings me back to, though, is that product manufacturers, you know, there's a lot of people that work at these on these teams that create all these products. And there's a lot of money being made. It's just kind of a bummer that, like, they didn't have the foresight to think about all this stuff so that we don't necessarily need to move into a world of regulation. Like, why are they dropping the ball so hard when there's so many capable people within these businesses to actually pay enough attention to this sort of stuff and to realize that it's important?
I mean, the market doesn't reward security. The market rewards quick. The market rewards cheap. The market rewards functions. And security is an afterthought. And some of these don't even get that. Equifax, Yahoo, I mean, lots of examples of companies that ignored security or at least underspent on security. I mean, that's what the market gives you. Now, a good regulation, if you do this right, spurs the market. If there is some rule that security has to be higher, companies will appear, things will be purchased, there'll be innovation in security. I mean, right now there's no real benefit. If my product's more secure than yours and it costs, you know, 1.5 as much and is 6 months late to market, I'm done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
What do you make of this story that's now about 3 weeks old, the Bloomberg story, chip story that never, like, we've never heard any proof, but I assume that you think that this is something that could happen, whether it really did happen in this particular way. But what do you make of Apple and, you know, and Facebook and these companies just saying that, or not Facebook, but Apple and I guess Amazon.
Yeah.
Saying this didn't happen. There's no way that it could happen. Or I guess they just said it didn't happen. What do you make of that?
I mean, this is a hard story. This is a supply chain security story. And the allegation is that networking equipment made in China was backdoored, presumably by the government, and shipped to the U.S. where it made its way into Apple, Amazon, and other data centers. This is a big problem. I mean, not necessarily this story. I actually think this story is not true only because I haven't seen a photo of one yet.
Yeah.
If this happened, if it was common, we would see a picture by now. But the general problem is common. Remember some months ago, Kaspersky? Should we trust Russian-made antivirus programs? Or around the same time, Huawei and ZTE? Should we trust Chinese-made phones and networking equipment? The problem is that our supply chain is so international and anybody can subvert it. Right? I use an iPhone, but it's not made in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Its chips don't come from the U.S. Programmers of that device carry 100 and something passports. So it is very international. And these supply chain risks are real. They're real for military. They're real for corporations. I mean, the U.S. inserted backdoors into Cisco equipment destined for the Syrian telephone company. We learned that from a Snowden document. Right? Again and again, we see these kind of supply chain attacks. They're pretty much impossible to discover. There are lots of ways to do this pretty much undetectably. And it's a problem we basically ignore. Bloomberg story is just one example. And the fact that we don't know one way or the other is actually part of the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're talking about regulation, you mentioned in your piece, the New York Times, that the EU, you know, has done some work here and they might act as a good model of what regulation would look like in this space on a broader scale. Why has the EU devoted enough time to this, whereas other parts of the world have not? Like, why is the EU setting this example and others still haven't learned that lesson?
I mean, the why, you should find some political scientists to talk about that. I mean, the what is that the EU is the regulatory superpower on the planet right now. And they are willing to fine internet companies real money. And they regulated privacy, GDPR. It's why you're getting a lot more warnings on websites these days.
Right.
And they're going to approach security. In the U.S., I look to the states. California just passed an IoT security bill. It's not that great, but it's a start. New York, Massachusetts are looking at similar things. And I think what you find is that a rising tide helps everybody. Yeah. I mean, just like you see warnings because of a European regulation, that California IoT bill will make our stuff more secure regardless of where it's sold. It means the economics of software. If you make the security improvement, you might as well sell it everywhere. And so I'm relatively optimistic, even though at the federal level, the U.S. government is probably not going to do anything. But I mean, here's the real argument. I think we are past the point of regulation versus no regulation, that the argument is smart regulation versus stupid regulation. Right? Governments regulate things that kill people. Once the internet can start killing people, government will regulate it. They're going to regulate it for cars, for appliances, for consumer goods, power plants, airplanes, medical devices, and then into everything else.
Yeah, and there's nothing to say that it's not already there. It just hasn't been used in that case, in that way, in such a broadly like recognized and obvious scenario that the government would feel like it has to act in that way. It's a really good point. Bruce Schneier, you're awesome, and we really appreciate bringing you on the show. You're actually going to be a guest on our long-form interview show, Triangulation, next Friday, October 26th, along with Leo Laporte, so we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, if you can find it, check out the new book, Click Here to click everybody.
Or, to kill everybody.
Click here to kill everybody.
You can't forget that subtitle.
That was a little redundant. Click here to kill everybody, which is a fantastic title. And people should also follow you on your blog. Where can they go to find that?
They're seeing it on the screen, Schneier on Security. Just type my name into Google and it'll find it.
Bruce, we really appreciate you taking time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, the new Pixel 3 and Pixel 3 XL is hitting people's hands. Most people would simply be happy about it and use it like the phone that it is, but not the folks at iFixit. They prefer to tear devices like this apart and document the process so you know what's inside. Joining us to talk about this dissection is Kyle Weens, CEO of iFixit. Welcome back to the show, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. It's always great to get you on. So you guys published your Pixel 3 and Pixel 3 XL teardowns yesterday. Much has been said about this new generation of Pixels being a marginal upgrade, I say, from last year in terms of hardware, more of a focus on software improvements. Did you find that to be the case when you finally kind of picked it apart and what you're staring at right now? What do you think?
Well, what's interesting is from a user's perspective, I could see how it's a marginal change. From an internal perspective, it's a radical redesign. They completely laid the phone out differently this time. So where in the past you went in from the front and I have a Pixel 2 here, and you'd take the screen off the front. With this, you actually go in through the back, and you remove the back, and then the screen mounts on here. So that's a pretty dramatic change. We actually started opening the phone from the wrong direction, and then got midway through and realized we had to change tack. So it's assembled more like the Samsung Galaxy devices than the iPhones that it used to be.
Yeah, you mentioned that a couple of times through the teardown, is that there's a lot of similarities with Samsung devices. Is that a good thing? I mean, how does that compare? How does that stack up?
Now, we're actually really frustrated by it. So there's two fundamental camps opening a phone. Do you open it from the front or do you open it from the back? If you open it from the front, then it's easy to replace the screen because you're taking the screen off first and then you can get at what's inside. What Samsung has been doing where you open it from the back is you pretty much have to remove every single component from the phone and you're left with the screen. And that has, particularly with the backs being glued on, that's made it really, really hard to work on the Samsung devices because you have this very like sticky, gluey back that you have to heat up and lift off, and then you get all the way through. People say, well, why does this matter? Well, if you break the screen on a Samsung device, it's really expensive. I hear a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to spend $300 to fix my Samsung. I'll just wait for the next one, where iPhone screen repairs are quite a bit cheaper than Samsung repairs.
So we should all buy iPhones instead of Android phones is what you're saying?
That's what Megan thinks.
I'm really frustrated by that. I'm kind of coming to that conclusion, but it's very reluctant. I've been a Pixel fan for a long time, and really, you know, we gave the last design a 6 out of 10, and so it really kind of broke our hearts to downgrade this guy to a 4.
I mean, is that something you think that Apple is considering, really trying to, would it be better for them to do it like Samsung is doing and like the Pixel is doing, to have it removed from the back?
I don't quite understand the advantage of designing the phone this way. I think Apple's approach is the right approach, which is design a robust, rugged display assembly that can be replaced. Apple absolutely is doing it on purpose. They're not doing it to help me or you out. They're doing it to help out their Apple geniuses in the stores.
Got it.
Right, because you can take your phone in and it'll do a display swap while you wait. Samsung isn't generally doing that. So the phone is designed for serviceability from the beginning. We like it when they design for serviceability, so we appreciate that Apple's doing it with the iPhone. We wish Google was doing it here.
Yeah. Well, that's a bummer. So from a repairability standpoint, you know, so much is spoken about these notches. It's kind of the dirty word of 2018 as it relates to smartphones. but in relation to something like repairability, you guys would be the right ones to ask. The Pixel 3 does not have a notch. The 3 XL does have a notch. Does that change repairability, ease of repairability, capability, all that kind of stuff in any way? Or is it just a different shape display and that's about it?
Yeah, nope. It doesn't change at all. We kind of like the notches. I mean, they don't really, one way or another, they don't really hurt serviceability. We're happy that we're moving away from the fingerprint sensors because there's been some challenges with the fingerprint sensors and repairability, particularly on the Apple devices. So I would say moving to a facial recognition system probably is better for repairability.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what are the biggest impediments to repair? Like what do you find? I know you do a lot of research into this. Is it people just thinking they can't repair it, not wanting to, like the cost of a new phone is so close to the cost of repair? What are the biggest impediments? Yeah.
That's a piece of it. You know, one interesting impediment is just psychological. People don't think that they can. And I, as we've been asking people, we'll ask why. They'll say, well, I'll void my warranty. And we say, well, but you already dropped it and broke it. You voided your warranty when you did that. So there's a psychological aspect to it. And then I think we've kind of tracked it down. The root causes these warranty voided for move stickers, which are on everything, right? You open it up, you remove the sticker to get inside. It turns out those stickers are illegal and unenforceable. So the FCC put out – or the FTC put out a ruling earlier this year telling companies to knock it off. Sony and Nintendo and Microsoft have all stopped putting it on game consoles, and we're pushing for lots of other companies to do it purely because it's a psychological barrier.
Interesting. Now, talking about the panel a little bit, you pointed out that there is a Samsung's like a running theme here. There is a Samsung display in there. I mean, how does that change things compared to last year? I think it was an LG display last year. Like, are they generally better in any way comparatively?
Yeah, from a repairability perspective, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Although we do like having multiple sources. So what's interesting is we took apart the Pixel 3 XL, the big one, and it had a Samsung screen. And then the next day, we took apart the 3, and it has an LG screen.
Oh, interesting. So I hadn't heard that.
They're dual sourcing it. And I don't know if all of the 3s have LG screens and all the XLs have Samsung screens, or if you bought two and on two different days, if they're dual sourcing it. So it's going to be very interesting to tell. And I'm looking forward to seeing reviews if people find that there's quality differences between the two displays, because assumedly they're calibrated relatively similarly. LG has just been racing to catch up with Samsung. And we know that historically LG's OLEDs have not been as good, but it sure seems like they're getting to the point where they're pretty close to indistinguishable. And I wouldn't hesitate to get the LG version.
So the only thing worse than people not thinking they can fix their phone, upgrading all the time, even when their phone isn't broken. But now there was an announcement that there's going to be a new Palm phone that you get in addition to your phone. So like your phone has a phone. What do you make of that? I mean, I was just thinking in terms of, you know, what you always convince people to do. What do you think of people we might in the future have like an extra phone just
for
the weekend?
Phones for our phones.
So on the one hand, I appreciate a new company. The company that's making the new Palm phone is this brand new startup. So good for them for being a startup deciding to make a cell phone. And I understand it's hard to go out of the gate and compete with flagships. So I feel like this is the way that they figured out to get in.
Yeah.
On the other hand, please don't have two phones. This is crazy. I mean, I can understand why. I mean, now the iPhone has dual SIM capability, so that's a good argument if you need to have two different phone numbers or be on two different carriers or when you're traveling internationally. But the amount of environmental impact that goes into manufacturing these things, I mean, it might be a lightweight phone, but there's over 500 pounds of raw material that goes into making a cell phone. It's really significant, and we should be trying to consume as few electronics, own as few gadgets as we can get away with. One of the great environmental wins for the smartphone is that it replaced your digital camera and your iPod and your voice recorder, right? There's all these other gadgets we used to have that we don't need anymore because we have this all-in-one gadget. And overall, that's better for the environment. So let's not go the other direction.
Except for the fact that way more people have this particular gadget than would have had all of those other ones probably added up, you know what I mean? So the net effect is probably that everybody has something instead of some people having an audio thing. And
that may
video.
Be true.
I mean,
so then we just have to figure out how we can make it last as long as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you talk a lot about e-waste. Obviously, it's a passion of yours and for the company. Wanted to ask you about your time last week at the eScrap conference in New Orleans, which that sounds like a lot of fun. Tell us a little bit about the event and what you were there to talk about specifically.
Yeah, so we don't think about the world of recycling very much, but you take your old electronics to Best Buy. Where does it go? Well, there's a whole bunch of companies around the world that will process your electronics. And so they'll get a gizmo, and they have to disassemble it to the point where it's safe to shred, and then they shred it and they'll recover the aluminum or the gold or the palladium that's inside these things. And you think of the manufacturers as doing this recycling, but they actually don't. None of the electronics manufacturers run recycling facilities. Instead, they contract out with these third parties. And so this conference is the Trade Industry Association for the recycling industry. And they get together and they talk about the problems they're having in the industry and what the opportunities are. And the main thing that they're talking about right now is fires. All of the electronics recyclers are having trouble with fires in their shredders, fires in their recycling plants that are caused by these integrated batteries. So this is the other teardown that we did recently. This is the new Microsoft Surface Pro 6. And as we took it apart, we spent a couple hours disassembling this thing. This is the bottom case. And we actually left the battery inside because we didn't feel like it was safe to remove the battery from it. So what I have left here, this is the bottom case, and then there's these brackets. You have the battery integrated in here. What a recycler would have to do is very carefully disassemble this, separate the battery from the aluminum so that they could recover the aluminum in recycling. And with this kind of device design, it's really, really challenging and unsafe for the recyclers.
What is the biggest contributor to e-waste? Is it, I mean, phones, a lot of people have phones, but they're smaller. Like what, and many people have more than one computer. Like I have a desktop and a laptop. So is, I mean, are computers a bigger contributor to e-waste than phones?
Yeah, it totally depends on how you track it. Historically, the big problem has been CRT monitors, the old lead cathode ray tubes.
Those are
huge, and those and they have 10 pounds of lead each, and they're toxic to deal with. You can't landfill them because the lead leaks. So that was historically the problem. Now the problem is that they've got batteries and all these electronics, and they may be smaller, but they can tend to like spontaneously combust. So that's an issue for safely transporting them. And also, all of the new IoT appliances, like your refrigerators and stoves, now have like Alexa built in. They have electronics in them, and there's gold that we want to recover in recycling those. And so if I'm not sure if you look at the overall weight of pounds of electronics being produced, if it's going down or if it's going up now that we're putting electronics in more things.
Fascinating stuff, and really happy that you're bringing so much awareness to it. Obviously, it's a big deal. We didn't even get into kind of the effects of all the trade wars that are happening right now, what that's doing to all of this recyclable waste, basically. It's shifting the machinations around how this is handled worldwide.
Right.
It's such a complicated process, so it's great that you're so at the forefront of this and bringing people making people more aware about it, because it really is a big deal. So,
and we're just going to keep writing about it.
Yeah, good. So when people go, I know that you have a particular section of ifixit.com devoted to this. What's the link that people can find that at?
Yeah, we just have it on the news on ifixit.com. Just scroll down and look at the news section. We're constantly writing about it. I wrote a piece in Medium last week talking about how Bruce Schneier is right and everything needs an internet off switch.
So, excellent.
We're very much aligned.
Confirmation across the board. Kyle Wayans, it's always great to get you on. Thank you for taking time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. ifixit.com. Thanks again, Kyle.
Thank you. After the break, is it possible to hire more women engineers and hire the best people for the job? The answer is yes. And even though I already answered my question, you'll still want to stick around because we are talking to the head of people for the language learning app Duolingo. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Now, what is your company doing to ensure passwords are being shared appropriately? LastPass Enterprise makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to your corporate data secure. It even allows for full customization of access, including giving you the ability to set a master password requirements, enable password resets, and you can also restrict access when you need to. You can configure over 100 policies. You can access security reports, see how everybody's doing on their passwords, and then even create shared folders. So if you do need to share a password, that those are all secure, and your employees who do need to have access to that will have access to it. You can organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and business information. You can also protect your business with multi-factor authentication. With the LastPass Authenticator app, a verification button pops up on an employee's phone to guarantee they are the only ones with access to their accounts. If credentials are compromised, the app ensures outsiders will not have access. The LastPass password generator makes it easy to use unique random passwords that employees don't have to remember. They don't have to write them down on little pieces of paper and keep them hidden underneath their laptop with a little corner where anyone can find them. They don't need to do that. Employees can log into LastPass with their Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly only have one password to remember. Data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass itself. Easy onboarding, password autofill. LastPass will make it easy for your business to take control of passwords and reduce the threat of a breach. And in iOS 12 and Android Oreo, autofill functionality makes it easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across mobile devices. So if your employees are like, oh, it's so hard on my iPhone, it isn't anymore. When you open an app or visit a mobile site, the keyboard itself will offer your username or password as an autofill option, similar to what autocorrect looks like now. No more copying and pasting from your LastPass app. LastPass also offers LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, and LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. I love LastPass. I've been using it since you could use it, and it just works and works even better on my iPhone. More than 16 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit and see which product is right for you. Late last week, the popular language learning app Duolingo tweeted that the company had achieved a 50-50 gender ratio for new software engineering hires, and they were aiming for a 50-50 gender breakdown company-wide. Now, many of the responses to the tweet were critical of the company, arguing against hiring people because of their gender, saying it was insulting to women, and worse. Joining us to clarify the hiring practices for software engineers at Duolingo is Christine Raich, Duolingo's head of people. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Megan. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you guys about the post and what was behind it, and then hopefully clear up some misconceptions that are out there.
I am hoping so, too. So some of the complaints about the tweet said that Duolingo must have had to lower standards, or they discriminated against men in order to achieve gender parity among software engineers. Now, is that in any way true?
Yeah, flatly no, right? So we definitely did not lower standards. We weren't discriminating. And it's so sad that something that as positive as this tweet was, you know, taken in that context and really looked at through that lens. So it's just disappointing to see some of those comments, to think that, you know, hiring more women automatically somehow means that we must have lowered the bar. It's really disappointing. I think the biggest misconception that was kind of underlying a lot of those tweets was this idea that somehow hiring is a zero-sum game, that if I hire a woman, I'm not hiring another qualified man. And I have to tell you, at least at Duolingo, we need so many qualified engineers, product managers, designers, that I would hire as many qualified people that hit our bar as I could. So this idea of it being a zero-sum game, it's just not true. Again, at least at Duolingo.
So give us like a high-level explanation of how the recruiting process works. I mean, you must have so many people apply for this job. Like, everybody loves this app. Everybody uses this app. So how does it work? Recruiting.
Yeah. So, you know, recruiting is like any other sales or marketing funnel. You know, you're starting at the top of the funnel, trying to generate a lot of interest and get a lot of people in at the top. And so there's really two ways to do that. One is, you know, people can apply through our Duolingo jobs page. We do get a fair amount of traffic there. But if you think about the type of person that we're after for these very specialized, world-class engineers, is really what we're after. If you think about that population, what we find is that we have to go actively recruit them. So we have to spend time at their schools, do these tech talks, talk to their student groups. We have to get in front of them because they're being so heavily sought after by so many other companies that we really have to be proactive. So, you know, it is this mix of passive candidates that we find through the Duolingo jobs page, but a lot of it is, you know, hard work out at the colleges and universities trying to drum up interest.
So this tweet came, you know, in the last couple of weeks or the last week or so. But the post, you guys had a blog post earlier in the year. It was in January that was also on this topic, how Duolingo achieved a 50-50 gender ratio for new software engineer hires. And there was something in there, I think it was within the first paragraph, where it notes that prior to the changes that you made in your hiring process, a number of the women that were offered jobs with Duolingo, none of them accepted. What would lead What do you feel led to those women passing on these roles, like the ones that you offer? What exactly was missing at that point that led to these changes?
Yeah, Jason, it's a great question. And I think we did a lot of soul searching after our 2016 hiring season. You know, we really went back and said, you know, what should we rethink in this whole process from beginning to end? One of the key things that we did was we had an unconscious bias training that we did with the whole company. And we engaged every employee in that training. And one of the workshops within that training was, hey, help us understand what might be happening in the hiring process. You know, what are those sort of unconscious biases or components of the process that may be less welcoming to different kinds of groups? And we got a ton of feedback from employees, things like, hey, you know, at the very beginning of the process, why don't we do a task that is automated in terms of grading instead of having a human be involved in that. So to kind of strip out the bias right from the very beginning, you know, thinking about diverse slates of interviewers, making sure those interviewers are all trained on unconscious bias, you know, really thinking about the environment that those candidates are experiencing when they get here, you know, the entire process from beginning to end. So we, you know, we talked to the candidates who turned us down. Again, you know, did a lot of soul searching. We asked the tough questions of those candidates and really listened to what they had to say. And we've kept in contact with a lot of those folks too over the years to try to get their feedback on how we could even improve the process and make it even better. So, you know, just a lot of time and attention on this, to be really honest. There's no magic solution here. It's just a lot of hard work looking at every single component of the process.
Now, did I read correctly that you were one of the Duolingo's first employees, like one of the first 10 employees?
Oh, Megan, if that were true, that would be amazing. I came along a little bit later. I wish that were true.
I don't know where I read that. So good thing I didn't spread fake news. It's not just about hiring, but it's, you know, keeping employees right. too. And we've all heard the stories of people who, you know, were hired and then the culture was just not a friendly place. And so they left. Like, are you doing anything to keep employees there that other companies might not be doing or that you think that is working better now than it might have worked in the past?
Yeah, Megan, it's a great point. We're really proud of our retention numbers. So, you know, we have a really low attrition rate. People, when they get here, they tend to come and they tend to stay. And they tend to stay, you know, we're 6 years old. You know, we have folks that have hit their 5-year anniversaries and on, which is amazing. And we'd love to see even more of that. But I think one of the things that's magic about this place is, you know, that connection to the mission, the idea of doing something kind of bigger than yourself. Once you get in here and you see the impact that you can have, it really kind of is this virtuous circle that kind of feeds on itself. I think the other part is, you know, we're small enough in terms of still being a startup where you get that all the benefits of being in a startup, you know, that feeling of ownership and, you know, you're really getting to push code that has impact really quickly on millions of users. And in a lot of the big companies, you just, you know, you're optimizing a button or a certain feature and you don't get that same feeling of that broad impact. You know, they're working on really tough engineering challenges. And I would say we have one of the best engineering departments in the world. So, you know, again, once you come here, there's so much opportunity to learn and continue to grow that people tend to stay. I think the other benefit that we have going for us that, again, can be a headwind in the recruiting process is Pittsburgh. So, you know, people really get sucked into the great lifestyle here. Cost of living is amazing. And so, again, once they get over the hump of maybe getting to Pittsburgh for their first time, then they tend to fall in love and stay.
Now, when you have a workforce that's equally distributed the way that you have at Duolingo, What are the effects from that? I mean, I feel like we've talked about this on the show, but I'm curious to hear how this relates to the Duolingo app and all the products that you create. What are the quality attributes that you see in your product as a result of that diversity? And I would venture to say that that's a really important, you know, it gains perspective from all different angles. But how does that translate into translate into Duolingo?
That's a good one. That was fantastic. Yeah, I think, you know, the end game for any consumer product is you want, ideally, you would love the people working on the product to be reflective of the end consumer, because sure. at the end of the day, you want to make sure that you're meeting their needs. Very global audience. So we do our best to try to mirror that. We still have a long way to go in a lot of the, you know, the other areas. But I think having folks that can really understand the experience from a user perspective and speak to what might be different for them and how they might be interacting with different features in ways that we wouldn't expect is really a key to success.
We're using the word diversity, and what we really mean, we're really talking about gender mostly, because I think one of the other criticisms of the tweet was there was a picture of all the women that you had hired, and many people pointed out that there wasn't a single Black woman in that group. So I know that that the CEO has talked about that and talked about how you're working to do better in that area. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we have work to do there. Our work in this space, in terms of really being an inclusive work environment, is frankly never going to be done. You know, there'll always be an additional kind of bar that we want to raise here. As I mentioned, you know, we have a global audience, so we want to keep in front of mind that consideration of making sure that our workforce reflects that dynamic as well. So we're doing a ton on, again, the university recruiting side. You know, we're doing a lot of partnerships with groups like NSBE and other local student organizations and trying to really get in and work with them more on the ground. So definitely we have work to do. By no means is our inclusion journey done, and I'm excited to see what will happen this year and in the future.
I'm curious to touch on something that you talked about a few minutes ago and go back to it, which is this your unconscious bias training. How much of a challenge is that? I have to imagine that in such a diverse, you know, workforce, people go into that thinking, oh yeah, there's nothing there. I'm not biased in any way. This is going to be a piece of cake. Is it an eye-opening experience for people that go through that where they're like, well, I mean, it's in the name, unconscious bias. They may right. not even be, you know, realize that. But what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this idea of unconscious bias is so important to unpack and explore in each company setting, right? Because I think it manifests itself in different ways in different company cultures. So here we did a really interesting activity where, you know, it's very research-based what we bring within Duolingo. As you can appreciate, there are, you know, scientists and engineers, and so they want to understand the research behind a lot of the practices that we bring to them. So we leverage the Neuro Leadership Institute's work on this topic a lot. And because of that, it's very actionable. So it's not just talking about the issues, it's talking about solutions as well. And so again, in a lot of the trainings that we did, we had workshops. And to the example of, you know, we talked about how unconscious bias can manifest itself in the hiring process, and then immediately went and said, okay, how do we fix this? Like, let's right now do a deep dive on our hiring process and make it feel like we're taking action and we're doing things to change it. So another thing that we did that I think went really well in this company culture was we used examples, like real life examples of how unconscious bias might be happening here. And so we used, you know, little, even, you know, interactions between colleagues or on teams or just little things that can happen. And we had little group discussions about those actual smaller incidents. So it just brought it home for people. It made it real. It was, how can I say this, Jason? It was like a colleague talking to their friend about what's important to them. And I think that's why it had such an impact here and really made a difference.
So I think a lot of the responses to the tweet are, you know, basically based in fear. Like there won't be a place for me. Like I won't get a job. My kids won't get a job. I mean, it's what we're seeing a lot right now. So so for young people or parents of young people, what recommendations do you have to really be prepared if software engineering at a competitive company like Duolingo is something that they dream of doing?
Yeah, it's, you know, first and foremost, you know, the basics, study hard. You know, we rely a lot on GPA as a screen. So, you know, make sure even at a young age that they're working really hard. But there's some interesting work that I think Planet Money did in the space of understanding why women started to leave the computer science field in the 1980s. And one of their hypotheses was that, you know, women started to opt out of the computer science major. You know, at the time, they made up like 35% of all computer science majors, and then it dropped off like a cliff. And one of the hypotheses that they had was that that corresponded with computers entering the home as toys. Mm. And because they were technology, it was a boy's toy, not a girl's toy. And so boys were socialized very early on to, you know, play with computers. And that's how you play, is with this tool, this technology tool. So really, you know, being aware of how we can expose girls and frankly, everyone to these different experiences, to not inadvertently close them off through socialization or different, you know, play, or in middle school, you know, starting to gate them away from math and science and pushing them a little bit. I hate to say that too, but, you know, when I think about my own experience growing up, my mom was a teacher, my dad was an engineer, and I thought that I would be a teacher because that's the mental model that I had in my head about what women do in the workplace. And it wasn't until I found myself in financial services many years later, in more of a technical career, that even my eyes were opened to what I was capable of and the possibilities that I had. So, you know, not limiting ourselves is also, I think, a really important part of this discussion, and pushing, you know, pushing people to do more, especially those young kids, you know, telling them that they can do anything is really important.
I hesitate whether to show this to my daughter or not, because I think you just said play more video games. If girls had played more video games.
Not sure, Megan.
Thank you so much for joining us. Christine Raich is the head of people for Duolingo. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you, Christine. We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Best of luck. All right, coming up, we tackle some seriously delicious news in the bagel world. But first, yes, you heard that right. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines that are a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets, and then, of course, you can customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. It's going to make developers really happy. They have an easy-to-use control panel and API that lets developers spend more time coding, which is what they really want to be doing, and less time managing their infrastructure. Also, industry-leading price to performance. You can access the compute resources that you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% when compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you're going to be paying per month, because there's a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Included at no additional cost, you get 99.99% uptime SLA, you get cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise class SSDs, easy to use API, and not just saying, over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean. So you'd be in good company. They do that to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. So you can sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Tech News Weekly.
The iOS world was rocked with scandal this week. New Yorkers expressed public outrage over the unappetizing bagel emoji in iOS 12.1 Beta 2. Now, instead of telling us we were looking at it wrong, Apple decided to change the emoji.
That was nice of them.
Joining us to discuss Bagelgate is emoji expert Jeremy Burge. Now, before we get started, Jeremy, are you also a bagel expert?
Oh, I like a bagel, but I've seen too many bagels this week. I have seen more bagels than I needed to in a lifetime.
You've been OD'd on bagels.
So first of all, did I get all the details correct? Correct me if I got something wrong in the telling of the Bagelgate.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. So Apple came out with the second beta of iOS 12.1 about 2 weeks ago now, and it had a bagel. And the most prominent critics of the bagel were the New Yorkers, but there were others. You can see it here that I know there were complaints about it being too dry, too thick, the texture's not right.
Does look pretty dry.
You know what? I saw some people complaining about the contents, but it was a lot about exactly the style of it. It was too mechanical, it wasn't organic enough. And so this week, Apple, they came out with a new beta of iOS and they, well, I say they fixed it. Some people still don't think so, but that's possibly another story.
Well, so here's my question. What is the bigger sin in the world of bagels? Is it perfect form or is it the exclusion of cream cheese? I want to know what the real problem is here.
You know what? So the feedback that I personally got and that came to Emojipedia, which again, we're not responsible for what Apple does, but I think people, they want to vent somewhere.
Yes, yes, of course.
Full. You know what? I saw some cream cheese fans, but it was really a lot about the texture. I didn't see everybody saying I demand it have cream cheese. They were just complaining that the texture wasn't right. And as a company that we come out with our own sample images each year as well, and we found this one really tough. So I can understand that. I think perhaps Apple figured out they couldn't make the texture look better in an emoji, so they just hit it with the cream cheese. I think that was sort of the way around it.
Well, there was a little more texture added to the bagel. Yeah. It looked less uniform, but
yeah, less perfect.
My question is, how did it get this far? I mean, it was iOS 12.1 beta 2. That's how far it got. 12.1 beta 2. How did it get so out of hand?
You know what? It's a good emoji, though. It might not be a tasty bagel, but the old one was a good emoji. You could look at that, and no one was confused that it wasn't a bagel. It's just that people have opinions about food, especially East Coast New Yorkers in particular, but anyone likes their food. And now, of course, that Apple's changed it, you start hearing from everybody else. We hear from people that in Montreal that it now doesn't look anything like a Montreal bagel. We hear from the vegans that it's no longer vegan friendly, potentially, depending on the type of cream cheese. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
could be made with cashews.
You can't win, honestly.
Yeah.
Cashew cream cheese is delicious.
I think the solution here, like we've already seen the solution in the world of emoji. We now have all different hair colors. Mm-hmm. For humans. We have all different skin colors for humans, obviously. We need all different bagel types. You know, there could be a sesame, there could be a cheddar, there could be a schmear or a lox. Like, when does the end? Stop the madness, seriously.
Can you imagine the argument? Right now we have one Unicode code point called bagel, and that can look like whatever vendors want it to. Different companies show it different ways. Can you imagine the outcry when only five specific ones are then picked? It's one thing to just say, look, this is up to companies. If you want to draw it with sesame seeds or without it, you can draw it however you like. Can you imagine the arguments then if you have to pick just five specific types?
Oh boy.
If you're the sixth most popular bagel type in the world, yeah. I think you'll make people even more mad.
Yeah, riots in the streets.
I think the Microsoft bagel emoji looks like a cantaloupe with a donut on top of it.
Yeah, it kind of does look like a donut.
Yeah. Microsoft said they look odd out of context. When you put them next to all the other Windows emoji designs, they look quite good. They all have this thick outline. But when you take them out of context, they do look odd next to the others, I'd have to say.
So some people, I guess, thought that the donut emoji was okay for the bagel emoji. But I do have an important question about the donut emoji. Now, I read that WhatsApp's donut emoji has strawberry frosting. So I'm wondering why anyone would still use WhatsApp if this is true.
Wow. Yeah, good point. I wholeheartedly agree. You know what? So what's fun about WhatsApp is that they have an emoji set that I believe it's mostly designed to sort of work around on Android. They used to use Apple's own emoji set, and now they've designed their own. And they want it to look, it looks a lot like Apple's, but every single emoji, they make one different decision. So you've got a frying pan that has one egg on iOS, and on WhatsApp, it has two eggs. You've got the tongue might face this way on iOS, and on WhatsApp, it'll face this way. So I guess they decided with the donut, even though everyone has the chocolate donut, they went strawberry. No good.
I love that you're an expert on emoji. It just brings a smile to my face because I have questions.
I have questions beyond the bagel. You go first.
I've got a whole list of food that people had issues with the paella before. Now people are
paella. Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah. What was wrong with the paella? Isn't all types of paella
traditional enough? It had shrimps and things, and the Valencians where paella came from, they don't do that in their meal. They put rabbit. They put chicken. They put beans. So Apple changed that last year without as much fanfare, I've got to say, that they sort of did it a bit under the radar. And now I'm hearing from prominent Mac commentator Federico Vitici. He's quite frustrated that the pizza emoji is very Anglo-centric, very American. It's got the pepperoni. He's from Italy, and they have the basil on there and no pepperoni. So you're always going to have some kind of contention about what is the true iconic version of any emoji.
I'm with Federico because I don't eat red meat. And so, I mean, just think of what we could do for the environment if we took away the pepperoni from the pizza emoji. We could change the world.
I'm conceptually on board, but can you imagine the outcry? If you take that pepperoni off that pizza, I think we're going to, my inbox will melt down.
Well, again, we just need different type of pizzas. Will there ever be a day where every single word that we type into a field is then replaced with an emoji? Like entire sentences? Like, I know we can kind of make that happen now, but I'm talking like type in English and then suddenly it gets converted and every single word is represented by some picture.
We are getting closer. And you know what? I think there could be a tipping point. I have some concern that we could hit a tipping point where we have so many objects and things encoded as emoji that then it's the exception when they're not. And then you feel like you have to encode everything.
Yeah. So
there are actually some issues there. It's one thing if you just say, look, we've only got a small number of emoji. There's 2,000 or so, 2,800 now. If you suddenly have 5,000, you actually get to the point where you could credibly make an argument that every type of vegetable or every fruit or every object has an emoji except this one. So I think there is some – you've got to be a bit cautious about actually adding too many in one go, or we could end up with that scenario where Unicode might feel obliged to add everything.
Well, that brings me to my next question. We chatted a bit on Twitter over this. I noticed there was no cheerleader emoji, and that upset me, and you were where I turned, of course. And you suggested the megaphone, which I think means you're yelling at someone. I was never a cheerleader. I got kicked off the pep squad in seventh grade, so I couldn't try out for cheerleader. But I consider myself, like, metaphorically a cheerleader for people. Like, I like to cheer people on, and I want to be able to do that in emoji. But, you know, someone chimed in on our Twitter conversation saying, like, cheerleading is sort of sexist. But, I mean, it doesn't have to be a female cheerleader. It could be a male cheerleader. Do you think, because I'm thinking I'm going to start the proposal, like, what's my first step? And should I not do this? Because then I would be tipping the scales toward everything needs an emoji.
You know what? I do think people are helpful emoji characters to have, smileys and people. I think the issue is maybe somewhere in the objects where you start getting odd things, like we had an abacus added this year and there's a magnet. And there are some edge cases where you might find them helpful, but some of these I'm not that convinced by. But the cheerleader, let's say you wanted to put in a proposal for that. Mm-hmm. One factor that works slightly against you is that humans do end up at least with a man and a woman version with all the skin tones. And vendors they're less likely. It costs them more to put that in their OS. It actually takes more memory per emoji. So any emoji that's a human is sort of has to meet a slightly higher benchmark than the rest of them. But nonetheless, if the statistics were good, I haven't looked at it, but hypothetically, if you compared cheerleading to tennis, or maybe I think Unicode used bowling as the median emoji for the sport to say bowling is about in the middle of all the emoji sports. Let's say cheerleading is more popular than that. If you search it on Instagram, on YouTube, on Google Trends, there is a reasonable chance that it would get up.
Who uses the lotion emoji? Like, that's the one.
Yeah. That started as a proposal sort of for sunscreen or some kind of sun lotion.
Okay.
But what often happens with these is they start as one thing, and Unicode don't like specific emoji options, so they like to generalize. So this is somewhat of a generalized, it could be some kind of sun lotion or sunscreen. It could be moisturizer. In the end, honestly, it's probably just going to be used in a creepy way by men on Instagram, and I feel bad about that for the women of the world primarily. But yeah, you do get some of these, and that is the challenge with these objects, right? Mm-hmm. Can they be used to harass, or are they just innocent and it's just like words and it's however we use them? You can use them in any given way. So that is a bit of an odd one.
Oh, this is the internet. Nothing is innocent. Jeremy, I have to imagine you have a list. You probably keep a list, keep it on your phone of the thing that you most want turn into an emoji. And then when it's done, when it's turned into an emoji, you're like, yay, and you check it off, and then you go to the down the list. I'm totally guessing here. What is something that you are holding out for an emoji?
I do have one, but I am a bit concerned about its multiple uses. But I am that annoying person that likes to photograph my breakfast, and I've got the avocado, I've got the bacon, got the fried egg. We don't have any sausage, and I'd really like a sausage, but yeah. I do also think it might not get used as a sausage. Mm-hmm. So I haven't proposed that, but I think it'd be popular. There's a lot of different types of sausages in the world.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of breakfast out there.
How that could be weirdly used. Yeah. I think there should be an emoji. I know there's never an emoji of a specific person, but there are emoji of careers. And I think emoji expert emoji, and it would look like you.
Oh, look like me. Wow.
Or we could get Rick Astley as an emoji. And then we could Rickroll people in emoji.
But that's a person. You can't do that.
I know. Well, I'm just saying the one and only, you know, the one and only person that you would bend the rules for would be Rick Astley. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, right?
Bend the rules for Rick.
Yeah.
You'd have to give it a different name. Like WhatsApp, you mentioned WhatsApp before. They've got the singing emoji. There's the man singer and the woman singer. Mm-hmm. And so in the Unicode spec, they're only called singers, but... Apple makes theirs look like David Bowie. WhatsApp makes theirs look like Prince. So there are some clever ways that you can get around. You have a generic code point, but then the vendors can do clever things. So this isn't a David Bowie emoji or a Prince emoji. It's just a singer, but you can do what you like. You could be creative with the Rick Astley and or the emoji expert emoji approval.
Right, because there are no other emoji experts. I mean, no one would quite be confused by that. I think.
Well,
yeah, that's true.
Unfortunately, I'm a most incredibly generic white dude on the planet, so I might look just like the normal. You know, you see on Twitter, you see a lot of. I see it a lot from more men than women, but everybody uses it where they put it in their bio. They put the person behind the computer in their Twitter name, but. Uh-huh. It kind of looks like everybody, and I think honestly, if you put a laptop about here on my face, I'm pretty much just the guy behind the laptop already, aren't I?
Kind of. I'll see which one I want to work on. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us. Jeremy Burge is Chief Emoji Officer at Emojipedia. You can find him on the Twitter or online at emojipedia.org. Thank you.
Always good to be here. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Jeremy. We'll talk to you soon. All right. Finally, I love me the music story. So when I saw this latest innovation from Google, I couldn't resist. It's called the Piano Genie, and it's a small breakout controller box with 8 little round colored buttons that you can connect to a sound device, or in the case of the included video, an actual 88-key stand-up piano. Google is all about its neural networks these days, of course. This is no different. It was trained using around 1,400 different piano performances from the International Piano E-Competition. That means that anyone can sit down to those 8 buttons and play them in whatever order or timing that they choose. And the algorithm will execute a piano improvisation to match, running up and down the keys, playing chords when 2 or more buttons are pressed simultaneously. Oh, there it is. Basically, with all of that neural network training and a little bit of timing skill on behalf of the air quotes pianist, you can get something that sounds incredibly authentic and emotive. It could turn you into a piano player,
Megan.
I know.
You could just bang on the keys and it could turn you in, too. So they also have it online. You can go to their website, I think, and just press the 1 through 8 keys and do it yourself, which I was spending all day doing it. Just like, I can play the piano.
Boom. Yes, it's on. So you'll find it on GitHub. They actually have the code posted on GitHub. And then, yes, the 1 through 8 keys on your keyboard. Oh, wow.
Oh, Victor.
You
have some real
talent. You are amazing. I didn't know that you could play. That's really, wow. See, not only is Victor our technical director of the day, he's also our resident
pianist.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. You're really good. We'll give you credit at the end of the episode. You'll get some royalties. You're about to make it to the big leagues, Victor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not that you hadn't already, being technical director of today's episode of Tech News Weekly. That is it for this week, everybody. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
Now, I've been listening to the Good Place podcast, and if you listen to it, someone I think in the chat room recommended it to me. Janet says this. She tells people to subscribe, so I'm not going to do it exactly the way that Bad Janet does, but I just, if you listen to the podcast, listen and just think, instead of just subscribing to the Good Place podcast, also subscribe to this podcast. Some of you just watch it and then you forget to subscribe and then we'll just slip out of your minds. You'll figure out you want to apply to make the cheerleader emoji or something. So subscribe, yeah. twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about all the uses of the lotion emoji, do not tweet that at me. Tweet something else at me. I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thank you so much for watching. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Victor. Thanks to Jammer B. Alex was in here earlier looking worried. We appreciate all of their work on this show each and every week. And we appreciate you watching and listening each and every week, too. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody. I'm not going to high-five your broken hand, though. There we go.